Hi there, it's Nick here. Thanks so much for your continued support of the Nick Luck Daily Podcast. Now, I know I've urged you on more than one occasion in the past to check out the racing app. And if you're a fan of US horse racing, as you know I am, never has this been more important, because the US service on the racing app is truly terrific. Not just the cards, very easily accessible for the day's racing, but also the video past performances, which are available completely free of charge, irrespective of any betting accounts, but also available at just one click. It's all there at your fingertips. If you are not resident in the United States and are a massive fan of American racing, this is the place you need to be. The Racing App. Download it today. You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis. By the Racehorse Owners Association. And by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares. Good morning, welcome to the show. It is Thursday, the 28th of March. I'm coming to you from the Media Centre, which is just paddock side here, at Maidan Racecourse, ahead of the Dubai World Cup. And whilst I blaze away in the scorching heat here, a story has been developing in Europe, and specifically in Britain, and perhaps even more specifically in Ireland, that has some pretty serious repercussions and consequences potentially for the entire breeding industry, and particularly for the health of stallions. Jane Mangan is with me this morning, and Jane, you can briefly explain why before we get into the veterinary weeds of this.
There has been a shortage in the EVA vaccine coming to Europe. EVA is something that a lot of breeders will be familiar with. We get our mares tested regularly. Biosecurity is such a huge thing, and in a generation of people who are very familiar with vaccinations, not only for themselves but for their animals, they'll understand the importance of such biosecurity measures. It seems this is very concerning for all breeders and stallion masters across Europe, because for some unknown reason there seems to be a shortage of the vaccine.
To tell you more is Dr. Des Layden, who you may have heard as a very successful breeder on the podcast before, but joins me today in his capacity as chairman of the Veterinary Advisory Committee to the European Thoroughbred Breeders Federation. Des, first of all, for the uninitiated, EVA, what is it, and why is it crucial that it doesn't exist in the breed?
EVA is a worldwide disease. It causes venereal disease in stallions, and the venereal disease can result in a minority in permanent infertility. So for that reason, it's a notifiable disease controlled by governments.
And there is a shortage of the current vaccine. And just explain the ramifications for that and how the industry has had to react.
We protect our elite stallion band against this disease in two ways: by vaccination and by compliance with what's called the International Code of Practice, which tests that the mares presented to the stallions are free of the disease. When you have vaccinal failure, that plank, our two-pronged defense, is forfeited.
So how does the industry respond, Des? When you've got a shortage like this, how do we have to respond, and how have we responded?
We've responded very well by having high levels of compliance with the codes of practice, but our problem is that this year's vaccine status is waning. The immunity that was there is gradually waning away, and we need vaccine for the 2025 breeding season. If we don't have it, then the entire elite stallion population across the whole Europe has been without vaccination for 2 years, in which case it will be acutely vulnerable to the disease.
I mean, and the potential consequences of that are unthinkable, aren't they?
Yes, they're very dangerous for the industry, and that's why we've argued for the introduction of a mandatory code of practice to help to protect against future vaccinal failures. But what we want is to be allowed to bring in the American vaccine called ARVAC, so that it is available, because it's produced in much greater numbers by the manufacturer and is profitable for them.
Okay, and so are we having success doing that? And are stallions, are members of that elite stallion band being vaccinated with ARVAC in the shortage of our once existing vaccine?
The ARVAC vaccine has not been allowed to be imported for the entire European stallion band. We are arguing that it should be because it's a very safe vaccine, and we've been able to demonstrate through the State Veterinarian's Office in Kentucky, where ARVAC vaccinations recorded 13,000 elite stallion vaccinations from 1985 to the present, and 100% voluntary uptake of that vaccine by the elite stallion band in Kentucky. We're saying we should be allowed to import that for the 2025 season if the ARTEVAC vaccine, which is now in manufacture failure, continues to be unavailable.
Okay, and are you getting the right responses from the departments of agriculture in the European nations?
France and Germany take the same view that Ireland does on this need for to have provision for importation of ARVAC for 2025, and I'm very pleased that at a meeting even during this week our Department of Agriculture have agreed to engage with us in the next 4 to 6 weeks to begin the process of exploring importation of the ARVAC, the live vaccine, for 2025. Well, we don't vaccinate the mares. We protect the stallion by making sure the mares are free of the disease. So the amount of vaccine that's required is significant, but it is that we are assured by the manufacturers of ARVAC that there is sufficient vaccine available to meet European needs to be as supplied from the USA.
Okay. And Des, finally, how worried are you about this?
I'm very concerned that if the immunity wanes for a further year, we have a very vulnerable stallion population.
Dr. Des Layden there, sounding not only an important note of caution and concern, but also sound counsel to those mare owners to be extra vigilant with all their testing before they visit any stallions. And it is clear that this has already had an impact on studs throughout Europe. Coolmore, for example, have had to delay the starts of Paddington and Little Big Bear because of this situation, though they assure us that having had vaccinations, those two horses are now back in full working order, and it is for the moment full steam ahead, so assuaging any concerns on that score. But to more fully understand that differentiation between the vaccine that was used and the live vaccine that Dr. Des Layden was talking about, and to understand the implications of that differentiation for British studs moving forward, I turn to James Crowhurst, who's a trustee of the Thoroughbred Breeders Association and also key advisor to them on such matters, and is a consultant to Newmarket Equine Hospital.
The way we would like to go forward is stallion managers would like their stallions to be protected by some sort of vaccine against EVA, and the only current alternative, if supplies of the ARTEVAC are not forthcoming again this October, is the American ARVAC live vaccine, which they have used for many, many years in America, which appears to be safe and effective. The problem has been over the years, when we have thought about trying to get it imported, is that a license has not been allowed previously, and this was many years ago, due to some issues manufacturing the virus. But this has not been tested in recent years, and going forward, any application by horse vets for particular named horses, which is the normal process that we go through to apply for drugs or vaccines that are not currently here, would have to be considered by the Veterinary Medicines Directorate and DEFRA. And they are always quite rightly circumspect about live vaccines for important diseases, because there is possibly an element of using a live vaccine in horses that might become positive for because they've got live vaccine in them for a while, and we know that the use of RVAC means that any stallion that receives it needs to be quarantined for 3 weeks after he has his dose, because he might shed a little bit of virus in his semen. As we know, EVA is transmitted by covering or sometimes close contact, and any stallion that catches EVA has a 30% chance of always shedding the virus in his semen, no matter what we might do. We can't get rid of the virus in his semen, so even if he was not covering naturally, the virus would be in his semen. So stallion managers are particularly anxious about not catching it. And this disease is prevalent on the continent and can be asymptomatic, so you might not know they've actually got it, which is a more of a worry for stallion owners and the industry. So any mares that come from the continent are always screened, and all mares are screened here before they're covered. So where we are at the moment is, if there is sufficient demand for the RVAC to be used for our stallions before next year's breeding season, then individual vets will be applying for it to VMD and DEFRA. They will consider any application, and it usually takes a month or so for them to consider this. Yeah. And decide whether or not they will allow the vaccine in here, and then we will use it. Now, we are in very good correspondence with our colleagues in America that have used it for ages, and they seem happy with it. But there are really two questions. Will the old vaccine reappear? And if not, do the stallion managers here want to try the live vaccine, and will the authorities
allow
decide
it?
They will let us import it?
And if you are wanting to shuttle stallions, particularly first season stallions who've not been vaccinated ever, is that going to be possible without the use of the live vaccine?
Well, at the moment, most of the shuttling goes to Australia, where they do not have EVA. So any stallion that's not vaccinated at all and is blood test negative would normally be allowed into Australia because he is negative, he's never had a vaccine, and that would normally be acceptable to them. Other countries may take another view, but we have been shuttling stallions that are positive to EVA on a blood test because they've been previously vaccinated. The difficulty would come that a stallion that is may remain positive to Artivac, the old killed vaccine, if we gave it a new vaccine, they might say, well, how do we know it's not actually got EVA anyway, because it's positive before you vaccinated him. We might have to do some semen tests. At the moment, any stallion that's never had a vaccine should be exportable to another country, either permanently or temporarily, being completely negative and never had a vaccine. The Australians could change their import conditions, but at the moment we think that something that is negative and never had a vaccine should be able to travel like many other horses do to Australia, because they're negative and they don't have vaccines.
So James Crowhurst there. And before that, we heard from Des Layden. Jane Mangan is still with me. And clearly, if we've got stallions and high-profile first-season stallions, as we heard in the statement from Coolmore, that have been out of action for a bit, it goes to show you that this is quite a serious situation. And we just heard from James Crowhurst that in Britain, it's not going to be that easy to get the live vaccine, even if Stallion Masters should choose to use it.
For sure. I suppose initially your first thinking is it's costly, you know, the monetary cost of horses being out of action. But I suppose the most pertinent point is the care of the individual horses and the importance of, I suppose, number one, breeders being vigilant with their testing of their mares and biosecurity measures, but also the Stallion Masters protecting their horses.
Yeah, and that point about the fact that a British government will need to specially approve use of a live vaccine poses further concerns, I suppose.
Yeah, and I'd imagine it'll probably be a jurisdiction basis. I'd imagine the Department of Agriculture over here are all over it as well. The highest echelons of Veterinary Council will be monitoring this. But I, you know, for everybody involved in terms of breeders and stud masters alike, you know, for 2025, I'm sure there'll be a lot of the best minds in the industry working to make sure that this isn't an issue going into next season. But we're into April now. We'll be, you know, there'll be a lot of business done at this stage of the breeding season, and I just hope that it hasn't been detrimental to the beginning of a first season sire who's standing this year, because their first book of mares is so crucially important in them getting a chance.
Let's talk about what's happening on the track this weekend. We'll talk a little bit of Dubai in a minute, but it's very wet in Ireland. Is that going to impinge upon the Irish Grand National meeting at Ferry House?
At the moment, I don't think so. I think everybody's happy with where it is. Peter Rowe and his team haven't expressed any undue concern. There have been declarations come in for the first day of the Ferry House Festival, which is obviously tomorrow, featuring a listed mare's bumper at the back of the card. Obviously, there's two grade ones on the Sunday in the Irish National on Easter Monday. So very much looking forward to that. Hopefully the sun is currently shining here in Ireland. Hopefully it'll be shining up in County Meath as well. And a little bit closer to my home, there's actually a very good card at Cork tomorrow featuring Paddy Toomey's One Look in a median auction race. Remember her winning the Goff's Million?
I think she's a massive price for the 1,000 guineas still, Jane. I really do. Because if you can take that form any sort of literally, she could be completely freakish.
She could be, and she's in the right quarters as well to be going very well in a classic. So there'll be a lot of eyes on her, and there's a lot happening at the weekend before we even look at Aintree.
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, even closer to your home is Jimmy Mangan's Spillane's Tower going to win the Grade One race that he won a few years ago with Connor Castle.
A few years ago, is it 16 years ago or 14 years ago? Yeah,
that's a few when you get to my age.
I haven't heard any complaints from mum or dad. They won't mind all this rain that's falling. And he seems in a very good place. They seem very happy with him. And I'd say for, you know, the likely field will feature Blood Destiny. So it would be round three with him. But, you know, meeting him back over 2.5 miles off level weights would be favourable compared to when we met him at Navan last time. And it'd be interesting if the likes of a Ilete Tomp or Found a 50 who ran so well at Cheltenham, if they reoppose just 2 weeks after the Cheltenham Festival. But he's going there fresh, and I'd say they couldn't be happier.
Okay, right, to the here and now, which in my case, and hopefully yours this weekend, means Dubai for a terrific edition of the Dubai World Cup. Those turf races are mouthwatering, and more of those in a moment. But the World Cup first, and I know quite a few of you will be enticed by the idea of playing the Crown Jewels Racing Fantasy game. It started off in Saudi and continues with leg two this weekend. And if you want to take on and beat, and you'll fancy your chances as well, me, Michelle Yu, admittedly a pretty sound judge, Frankie Foster, all right, I'd fancy my chances, and Tom Stanley, I definitely fancy my chances. You can win some wonderful prizes as well as the bragging rights. Just check out fantasy.crownjewelsracing.com and you will be able to see all the details. So you've got to select your top three. My top three are as follows. I've gone in third for Derma Sotogake, the winner of the UAE Derby last year. In second, the defending champion Ushba Tesoro. And I've gone for a bit of a wild card as my team captain to earn me maximum points, Laurel River, former Bob Baffert trainee, now trained out here by Bhupat Simar. Wonderful pedigree. And I've just got a feeling that he might be able to get out on the lead and lead all the others a merry dance in what is quite a difficult race to fathom tactically. And earlier today, I caught up with his trainer.
Well, I'm feeling great. I think we've got some live chances, some good horses going in there, and they've had some good prep. So, feeling great. But, you know, when you're in these big races, big championship races, you got to fire, you got to get it right. And, you know, we've been there on both sides of it
before. Now, I've been trying to fashion a case for Laurel River, who's a Judmont-owned horse, was very talented in America for Bob Baffert. You've had the horse a little while now. Is this a 10 furlong horse? Is this a horse with a talent to take a hand in a World Cup?
I think he's going to be better with 10 furlongs. You know, he's a very high-class horse. We can't get the bottom of this horse. You know, anything he does, he just does it too easy. He's always got his ears pricked. He never blows anything. So I think he'll be better at 10 furlongs.
There's a lot of 10 and even 12 furlong horses in his pedigree.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's out of an Empire Maker mare. And as we were discussing yesterday, I think you've studied the pedigree more than I have. And his dam is half-sister to a couple of Group 1 winning mile and a quarter fillies.
Yeah, so fingers crossed. And is he training well enough?
He's training very well.
Now, the draw yesterday, you were the only trainer who looked a bit disappointed because he's got a lot of natural speed. There's not a lot of pace in the race. Will you be able to get over from an outside gate?
Well, when he won the mile race, he was drawn 14. You know, I would much rather be in 12. We've been on the other side of it with North America, where we were drawn 2 and he was a speed horse and he missed the break. So at least from 12, an outside draw, you got a bit more chances. And, you know, you're the one who's going to be putting pressure on other horses rather than they putting pressure on you.
And of course, the man who used to train this horse, when he comes here, he'll always want a draw middle to outside rather than down on the fence. And his horses always go forward.
Yeah, exactly. And then this is how he does as well. This Laurel River, he's a natural speed horse. And if they want to go with him, they'll have to run very hard to go with him.
And for you, as someone who's been so immersed in racing in Dubai for such a long time, to have a horse, a Judmont-owned horse as well, in a race such as this, with a chance, how big a moment is that for you?
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. This is what every trainer dreams of, to have an owner like Judmont. I mean, they've been around for so long. They've had legendary horses, and you know, for them to send me a horse, it's a great privilege, and I'm very grateful. And then to have a horse with that kind of caliber in those biggest races in the world, it's absolutely immense.
As I said, you've got a lot of runners, too many to go through individually, but of the remainder, which excites you the most, either for now or for the future?
I think that Mendelssohn Bay is going to be a good horse
in the UAE Derby, and of course by previous winner of the race.
Yeah, he's by Mendelssohn out of a curling mare, so they both won on Dubai World Cup night. I think he's going to be a very exciting horse going forward, and we've got some good ones. I like Walk of Stars, I like Toes, I can't forget Remorse. He's been in 2 Dubai World Cups and he's been in Saudi Cup, so he's a classy horse. I think we've got some good horses going in there.
Bupa, all the best.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you.
Well, I think without doubt the most intriguing horse in the Dubai World Cup is Señor Buscador, because he has chiselled his way into the hearts of not just race fans in the United States, but around the world. Really a bit of a throwback, a horse who's now run at, I think, 15 different racetracks, won the Saudi Cup, was beaten a couple of nostrils, really, in the Pegasus, and his owner and breeder is Joey Peacock, who's with me now. Joey, there's not much more you can say about this horse other than to just admire his constitution. How proud are you of what he's already achieved?
Oh, we're extremely proud of the horse. Like you said, he shows up every time and he tries hard. His running style makes it hard for him. He's going to be at the back of the pack early on, but he comes flying at late when it counts. And sometimes he gets there, sometimes he doesn't, but it's always exciting.
You've been breeding racehorses for a long time. You and your late father were very interested in the art of it and the science of it, I'd suggest.
Absolutely. Yes, my father probably more so in the art, and then obviously with computers and all the software and platforms you can get for breeding analysis these days, I like to look at that as well. But yes, it's much more of an art than a science.
And have you always chosen stallions for your mares based on their relative physical attributes, or how have you done it generally?
Well, we've been very fortunate with Rose's Desert because she doesn't have any attributes that we're trying to breed to overcome, so that opens it up pretty much to any stallion we want to go to. But no, what we like to look at is we like to see a longevity of the race record, obviously performance on the racetrack. We like to breed for soundness, and we're not breeding to sell, we're breeding to race, so that doesn't handicap us by what the market's hot horse is. So yeah, we've been very fortunate to get some nice race horses.
And you can just afford to swim against the tide a little bit. Does that make it more satisfying?
It's kind of fun. We do our own thing, and so far it's worked. I would say it's kind of old school. I think a lot of people used to do it that way, but the business has changed over the years. But what we're doing is working. I think we'll just stick with that.
And you say old school. I describe this horse as a bit of a throwback to another era where horses ran a lot.
Right.
And horses could actually close from off the back. And that's not something we've really sort of seen as a trend in the last decade and a half or so.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where you really need the stamina and the performance and the ability to have a long career. And, you know, for us, the fun part of this business is racing horses. So if our horses are healthy and well, and it doesn't really matter their age, but if they're training well and they're racing well and they're competitive, that's what we want to do. We want to race our horses.
So your trainer, Todd Fincher, he is now, I think, unequivocally New Mexico's finest export in terms of training racehorses. He said himself, "I'll train anything you like," and has done to great effect. But it really struck me when we were talking last night, and I said, "Oh, this must be so great, and you must be so proud, and isn't this horse wonderful, and you're on cloud nine." He said, "No, I've got 89 other horses back at the barn I need to worry about as well." He's not exactly letting it go to his head, is he?
No, he doesn't. Not at all. Todd's very grounded. The thing we love about Todd is he puts the horse first always. It doesn't matter what level of horse or what the timing is if an issue comes up. We've had to scratch and had to miss big events because horses weren't in the right shape to perform. So, yeah, Todd's an excellent horseman, and we take our horses wherever Todd goes.
And I was struck going back to the pedigree of Senor Buscador that you should have chosen Mineshaft, and Mineshaft wasn't a young horse when you sent your mare to him, and I remember him starting his life running at Newmarket for John Gosden, and then of course he came over and did what he did for Neil Howard in the US. What was it about him that you particularly liked?
Yeah, so my father liked the longevity. He had a long career. He liked that he performed at the classic distances, so that indicated stamina, and he won a lot of money, which to him was a proxy for, you know, being a good fast racehorse. So he kind of ticked all those boxes for us, and again, because we weren't breeding to sell, we were breeding to race, we thought we might get a proper racehorse out of him.
I do feel like I'm slightly stalking you around the world now, from Miami to Saudi Arabia to Dubai, but it's been a great journey these last few months, and you've had most of your family to enjoy it with you. Who's on the team for this trip?
Yeah, so my wife and I have five adult children. They're all grown and they all have their own children, so it's busy, but three of our children and their spouses are here.
That's pretty good strike rate, Eric.
That's a pretty good turnout. We're 60%, so yeah, that's about as good as it gets for us.
Okay, and everybody enjoying it?
Absolutely, everybody's having a ball.
Well, that's a preview of some of the key contenders in the Dubai World Cup itself, but the turf races are going to be attracting interest from all over the world. They're so stacked, that particularly the Dubai Turf, 9 furlongs, and the Shima Classic, a mile and a half race won by Equinox last year. And boy, oh boy, is it a good race this year. The Japan Cup runner-up to Equinox, Liberty Island, getting the sex allowance off August Rodin, the Breeders' Cup Turf and Dual Derby winner. Plus, throw in Emily Upjohn, who was brilliant first time out last year in the Coronation Cup, and others. Winner 2 years ago, Shariar, and all sorts of horses at monster prices who are of grade one or group one caliber. Jane Manger, this is an absolute belter. How do you see it shaking down?
Look, I'm kind of jealous that you're out there, and not just for the weather. The international flavor is just incredible. You just mentioned those horses like Liberty Island versus Auguste Rodin, throw in the 5-year-old Emily Upjohn, and even flicking down the way through Stars and Earth, Andre Farb's Junko, Shariar, Spirit Dancer's like 20-odd to 1 after what he did in Saudi last time. That's, as Shima Classics go, I'd say that's as deep a renewal as I've seen for a very long time. And you mentioned the Dubai Turf. Doe Juice is top of the market. I thought there was some crazy prices in here. Is Nashua something like 8-1?
Well, Nashua's got a terrible draw. That's the problem. She's actually bigger than that now. You can get her about 14-1 because she's drawn in 16, and that's the issue. 9 furlongs in 16. I mean, I don't know how Holly Doyle navigates that. I guess she's going to... Well, you either drill forward or go right back. And I guess you're just going to have to go right back and try and weave your way through.
I can't imagine first run of the year they want to drill her forward, and then you throw in the curveball of Luxembourg. Okay, I was a little bit disappointed with what I saw with him behind Spirit Dancer last time, but if you just take the best of his form, I think he's a huge price in that. Of course, Lord North, would this be a fourth?
Fourth, yeah. Yeah, this is the toughest group he's run into yet. I mean, it's going to be an absolutely superb bit of training if the Gosdens can pull this off.
Didn't think he ran too bad in Lingfield.
It was Southall this time, wasn't it? It was Southall this time. That's the thing. They moved it to Southall that race, and it was a furlong too far for him. So I actually didn't think he ran too badly at all. But it's just a better group of horses. Yeah.
And of course, when we watched Auguste Rodin work at Dundalk a couple of weeks ago, he worked with, I think, Henry Adams, who contests the UAE Derby. I'm not saying Henry Adams was working up alongside Auguste Rodin, but that was the company he was keeping. Is Forever Young that good? Is his form that good?
Well, I think he's very good, but it's just a question of whether he's acquired a bit more street wisdom than he showed in Saudi Arabia, because if he's that green round here and doesn't change his legs again, then I think this group will get his measure.
Yeah, I think he could do with a better passage too. Like he was trapped very wide that day, but stall 11 probably won't help.
Well, if you were one of the world's great commentators, you'd dream of calling this race. And there is a new voice for the Dubai World Cup this year. Here's Laura King with more.
You can be forgiven for never having heard of him. At the age of just 28, Patrick Comerford will call his first Dubai World Cup on Saturday, placing his binoculars in the space once occupied by the redoubtable Terry Spargo, Derek Thompson, and more recently, Larry Colmus.
It's an older profession, so it's not something where you do see a lot of people, I guess, you know, in their 20s doing it, especially, you know, at a job in a place as prestigious as Dubai. So very honoured, and I'm very happy that I get to live my dream every day doing this job. I think it's a mixture of nerves coming into next week, but I think most of all the thing I'm excited about is just the fact that, you know, I guess there's been an element of trust that's been thrown into me going into next week. It's a big privilege to call the Dubai World Cup and all the nine races on the program. One of the most prestigious race meetings in the world. And, you know, I came into this job at this season with full well knowing that it wasn't on the cards, and they've entrusted me with the role. It's quite exciting.
With no background in racing, Pat did it the hard way, starting off on the airwaves in his native Australia.
I called my first race 6 years ago in Central Australia. I was working up there as a breakfast radio presenter, and the job opened up at Alice Springs Turf Club for a commentator to call their 30 meetings a year. And I was fortunately, I think due to the remoteness of the place, I was sort of entrusted with that job. I came into it with no experience. I had to learn on the job as we went along. For a good chunk of the year, you're racing only once a fortnight, and there's not a lot of trials. So it was really learn on race day kind of stuff. And I was there for 2 years, moved to New Zealand and got a job there with TAB Trackside just before COVID. I was there during the lockdown and had, I guess, some opportunities with racing, but more so it gave me an opportunity to call a lot of trials. And I mean, thousands of trials in a couple of years. And that, I think, really helped me with my job. From that, I got the job in Singapore on the back end of COVID, racing to closed crowds there and was there for 2 years. And obviously with the announcement that Singapore was closing, Dubai came up on the radar for the upcoming season. And well, with the news that Singapore was soon to be no longer, it only felt right to apply.
Pat's excitement about Saturday's $30.5 million race day is palpable, but he'll be happier once one race in particular is out of the way. The Alquaz Sprint over the straight 6 furlongs.
I think straight racing is always going to be a new element to a lot of callers, myself especially. In Australia, we have straight racing, but we only race at Flemington, and there's a straight 5 race, a straight 5 track at Pinjarra in Western Australia. And other than that, we don't race down the straight. So it's shoot racing's very new, but I think, you know, you just got to be very quick paced, much like the horses, get through the horses and get through the runners, and I think you'll be okay.
Give us a tip then.
I can't go past the Kazakhstani horse Kabir Khan in the World Cup.
Now you know all about the new voice on the Maidan mic.
All right, well, it's been far too long since we checked in with our friends at Kentucky Equine Research and Saracen Horse Feeds as part of our series devoted to informing everybody in the thoroughbred industry and beyond a little bit better about the way we feed our horses and how we can use technology to improve our understanding of that. Joe Pagan is the founder of Kentucky Equine Research, Polly Bonner, the director of Thoroughbred Nutrition at Saracen Horse Feeds. And last time you were with us, we talked and we previewed the Kentucky Equine Research Conference, which took place in Florida at the beginning of February. And now we can review some of the findings from that. And Joe, I get the strong sense from speaking to Polly over the last couple of weeks and the strong sense from seeing you today that you were pretty pleased with this. Tell me a little bit about the conference and its highlights.
Nick, I was really pleased with it. First, I was really pleased in the quality of the speakers. We got sort of the best in different areas, all different areas of health and nutrition and well-being in horses. And they did a fantastic job explaining recent developments. And the thing that really struck me was how many developments actually have occurred recently. The change in technology is just incredible. From 10 years ago to today, what we've learned because of new techniques that have been developed in the field.
Was there something that really stood out and astonished even you?
Well, I don't know astonished necessarily, but I'll give you a good example of how we've been chipping away trying to understand things for years and years. We did an experiment 10 years ago, just 10 years ago, where we're looking at how well horses could restore glycogen in their muscle after exercise. We did the study. We took bits of muscles. We used the techniques that were available then to measure these changes. Fortunately, we stuck those samples away in the deep freeze. And now there have been, over the last 10 years, such advancements in how you can analyze changes that occur in muscle using some techniques called proteomics and transcriptomics that basically show how cells turn on and off genes, that we were able to find much more about that exact same experiment that occurred 10 years ago using these new techniques, and discovered something truly novel, that horses are completely different than humans and other animals and how well they can actually replace glycogen in their muscle exercise during exercise. And that was only 10 years ago. So it's just amazing the progress we've made.
So how is that then likely to manifest itself on a day-to-day basis? How is that research going to be translated to the way we do things, the way you do things for us?
Yeah. The reason it's so important is we've always been baffled why we can't get horses to replace the glycogen after it's used during exercise, because the normal pathways that you would have studied in a mouse center or a human, the things we were doing should have worked. Now that we know that there are other pathways at play, we can try different techniques to achieve the same goal. We haven't found those techniques, but now we know where to look. So that's why it's so important. And what we're finding as we go along is that there's a number of different areas where horses are truly different in terms of their metabolism. And this is just the latest example.
Okay, so when we come to putting that into practice, it will mean what for our thoroughbreds?
It will mean that we will be able to refuel the muscle quicker and more efficiently. And so the horses can return to their former pre-race status earlier.
I mean, that's a complete game changer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It really is. And just to understand why horses were different, because we tried all of the traditional methods that you might have used in a human and got no response. But now these data are starting to show we know why.
Okay. So would that for you have been the highlight?
Well, that was one of the highlights. The other big technological change that you're seeing as well, and I'm sure you've reported on a lot, is the advent of wearables. This technology now to go out into the field is just incredible. because before we were encumbered by using, you know, high-speed treadmills and putting horses in pretty artificial environments. Now to be able to make these measurements under real field conditions is a truly a game changer. We had on the at the conference a veterinarian named Emmanuel Van Urk. She's a Belgian veterinarian who's really been a trailblazer in terms of using this technology to diagnose poor performance in the field. She's working with a French group that has a system called Equimeter that I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be using in thoroughbred training. And these data are literally changing our understanding about what we're doing in the field. We've added some to that by the use of microchips now, where we can implant them in muscle groups and measure how much heat is produced during exercise. We're combining all that technology now, and we have a new group of two-year-old racehorses at our research facility in Ocala. We're using this technology as they go into training so we can understand how they change with training, how they're affected by heat, most effective ways to cool them down. None of that would have been possible without this wearable technology.
That's incredible. Yeah, we've been speaking about it a lot, and certainly it featured heavily in the interview I did with Lisa Lazarus the other day on our USA edition. Heisa, very hot on the use of wearables to try and advance the well-being of horses and the welfare of horses in training. Polly, as somebody who attended the conference and has been attending KER conferences, where did this one rank?
Oh, I'd say it was one of the best yet. Joe pulled out all the stops in terms of the speakers. I mean, it was literally a who's who of all the experts that he got together. And do you know, one of the things that was really cool sitting there in the audience, and I must admit, I sat right up the front because I didn't want to miss a thing, but it was the interaction between the speakers. You know, the speakers would all be equally listening to the person who was presenting, and then they would be asking their own questions of said presenter. And that isn't something that you always see. The back and forth was really interesting. And you know, the other thing that was fascinating was it was a pretty tight schedule. I mean, Joe had packed them in. There were enough breaks, but, you know, he made sure that we were there to learn. And nobody moved. You know how quite often in those sorts of environments, people get up, take a phone call, you know, go back and get a drink or go and use the bathroom. I mean, nobody left the room. They were just completely focused on each presentation.
And when
and that is, I think, pretty unusual.
And when you go around then to your clients in the UK and elsewhere, and they say to you, right, what's coming next? You can give a little pricey like the one that Joe gave me. It must excite them hugely.
Oh, well, just the capacity for learning when you work with Joe and his team is endless. And that's what really gives us confidence that we can keep bringing back something new, but actually new and meaningful and practical, so that we can explain what these researchers have said and put that into a real life environment, as Joe explained. And just to be a little bit geeky for a second, it was really cool to meet some of the speakers where I've been reading their published research for years. I mean, I should have got over this now because I've been around Joe for long enough, but you kind of don't. And when you hear them present it, and they were a very engaging bunch, it just motivates you to want to bring that information straight back to your own client base and help them understand how that's going to improve what they're doing and how they're training their own horses. It's terrific from that perspective.
And one thing, Nick, I want to say is we have made the proceedings from that conference available on our website.
Yeah.
And we've tweeted out the link to it, but we made the proceedings in an interesting format. It's a question and answer format where we ask the speakers directly sort of the questions you're asking us. What does it mean to the veterinarian, to the racehorse trainer? So I would encourage everyone to go to our website, download the proceedings, and they can read about some of these advancements.
KER.com.
Yep. And we've put them on our website too, but Joe's quite right. KER.com. The whole way that you can basically kind of read a chapter, come away, read the next one, you know, it's much more user friendly in some ways. It's very easy to get the information out. And the questions that were asked, like Joe said, they're exactly the kinds of things that we know trainers, breeders, owners, vets will be asking themselves. It's a really nice format.
And if you are having a conversation in 10, 20, 30 years' time and wondering why horses are trained better and more efficiently, why we're taking this game into the next generation, the answer lies in conversations like this one and the KER conference of 2024. Joe Pagan, Polly Bonner, thanks so much.
Thanks, Nick.
All right, Jane Mangan is still with me and has a tip for you for today.
Off to Wetherby, and thank God it's on. 12 runners in the 355 handicap hurdle makes it competitive, but I hope Montregard can run better than we saw him at Newcastle last time. Tom Lacey's reached for the cheek pieces, and Stan Shepherd is now back aboard the horse that won his maiden hurdle at Warwick back in April. I think Montregard can run a big race to give Tom Lacey a birthday winner.
All right, Jane, thanks so much. Thank you very much for your time. That was Thursday, the 28th of March. I'll be back to do it all over again tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with FitStairs.